the French and the Italian representative tried to really attack me at a very personal level so that I would not perform at a professional level. And they were very successful with that for the first few years. And then after a while, it takes time to grow into a position, like it's taking me time to grow into the position I'm in now. Equally, when I moved to Brussels, I had to grow into that. I had to find my bearings and, you know, get my footing before I could start to deliver any kind of value.
This is the Indianness podcast, stories of success from leaders and change makers of Indian origin. Why have Indians achieved success across so many different disciplines around the globe? I have no idea, but let's find out together because every story is unique. I'm very excited to have Aarti Hola Maini with us today. She's the director of the United Nations Office of Outer Space Affairs. She spent almost all of her career in space-related activities. I invited her on this show as I was fascinated by her very unconventional career journey. Welcome, Aarti. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Thank you, Sanjay. I appreciate you approaching me for this.
Wonderful. Aarti, our show, Indianness, is basically about chronicling the life journeys of change makers like you. Really helps people who listen, who get inspired, who look at all of you as role models to figure out, you know, how your journey went, how, what lessons they can learn from that. And in order for us to do that, we really start always from the beginning. And we'd like to know, where were you born? Tell us about your parents. And then we'll dive much more deeper into right at the beginning of your journey.
Thank you. Sure. So my mother was born in Lahore, pre-partition India, and then after partition moved to Dharamsala and Jalandhar, where she went to college, etc., before being found as the perfect suitor for my father, who had been essentially raised in Nairobi in East Africa. But while he was growing up, he spent 6 months of the year in Ludhiana and 6 months in Kenya. I have three brothers. They were all born in Nairobi, and the family moved from Kenya back to India in 66. And 3 years later, my parents had gone to the UK to renew their passports, and my mother was 7 months pregnant with me already, so could not fly back. Otherwise, I would have, should have been born in Delhi, but I was born in the UK. We did, however, live in Delhi for the first 2.5 years of my life. That was in South Egg, C Block. And I came to the UK in 72 and grew up there.
So any memories of Southex at all?
No memories of Southex, but I've had wonderful trips back to India many times. I met my husband through meditation. We both meditate. And so we made frequent trips to India until very recently.
Wonderful. So tell us a little bit about dad and mom. What did they do professionally, personally? Would love to know a little bit more about them.
I have to be honest, I come from, well, my parents came from really, really privileged backgrounds. On my father's side, the Maini family was a big family of industrialists. It was still very big in India, in Bangalore. You may have heard of the Maini group. But one portion of the Maini family went off to East Africa and was instrumental in the industrial revolution over there. So did very well themselves. My mother also comes from a very big family in India. She has her father and her grandfather were both Rai Bahadurs. And there are roads in Lahore, which are still named after various ancestors of mine and so on. My father was a pharmacist. He studied in the UK, had a pharmacy in Kenya and then in London. My mother trained as a teacher, but after marriage, she became a homemaker.
Wonderful. A family maker. So when you were in the UK, what was dad? They shifted obviously from Kenya to UK. Was he a pharmacist in UK?
Yeah, they shifted from India to
UK.
Yeah, and he was a pharmacist.
Okay. And mom was staying home at that time.
She stayed home. He did work for a couple of years in an insurance company. He didn't follow her training as a teacher, which I think is unfortunate, but she trained us very hard at home.
Yeah, obviously. And you have three older brothers. Wonderful. So Aarti, tell us about the early years of growing up in London. You were going to school there. What was it like? Walk us a little bit through that journey. Did you feel you belonged there? How were the school? You made any friends? I'm talking about the early years of growing up in UK.
I don't recall ever having the sense of not fitting in, apart from the way that I was raised. But that's not the very, very early years. That really, I became conscious of that when I was about 16, 17, 18. If I can just comment briefly on that phase. Everybody, the friends at school, they used to be invited to birthday parties and so on. And while I may have gone to plenty of birthday parties being very young, when we got older, it was more difficult. I recall going to one friend's 17th birthday party, but having to leave already at 9:30 because it wasn't the dumb thing to stay out late. So that, I think that's the time when I felt different and felt a little odd and uncomfortable that I might not fit in entirely. But the, for the rest of it, I don't have any recollection of not fitting in. No, I was quite a goody-goody. You know, I think I was made the class representative once. The teachers generally liked me. By far, I wasn't, you know, one of the smartest in the class, but I was probably one of the sweetest in the class in terms of good behavior.
And how was school? Were there any subjects or courses that you were more inclined towards early part?
Yes, I was always good at languages. And I kind of felt that it was the only thing I was good at. I struggled with anything which required independent thinking. I found anything that required logic okay, even though I found maths quite difficult, which it's quite a trauma for me even now because Indians are meant to be good at maths. And I did get an A in my O level, but what I remember, you're asking me about when I think back, I just remember having my older, very, very smart mathematical scientific brothers trying to teach me maths or help me with homework. And me just ending up in floods of tears because I understood nothing. So, or at least I thought I understood nothing. Yeah.
So math was not a great subject, but you obviously were good at languages. How about friends? Did you make any friends during that process?
Yes, I had great friends. Let's just come back to maths for one second. Even though I thought I was not good at it, I left to my own devices, if I'm taught something logically and slowly, I'm fine. I got an A in my O level and I wanted to do it at A level. But in the school, we had to pick subjects from given columns. And I knew I wanted to do French and German, but French and maths were in the same column, which means they would have been taught at the same time. You could not do both. So I dropped maths and that was the end of maths in my life. And that's, you know, a challenge even today.
So do you think that was a good decision to leave maths at that point?
There's no point in having any regret.
Yeah. But, you know, looking back, sometimes you don't have regrets, but you'll have inflection points. So were you in the same school through the entire time, Arthi?
A different junior school and a separate secondary school. But yes, from 12 to 18 or 11 to 18, one school. It was a girl's.
It was all girls' school?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was around the corner from home, and my mother made sure that every single evening I had an activity. So one evening it would be gymnastics, one evening was tennis, one evening was badminton, one evening was something else. Yeah, one evening was the Bharatanatyam, actually. So, you know, every evening was something.
Oh.
Whether I had it or not.
Yeah. And then where mom and dad involved in your studies, helping with any homework or anything like that? Or
they
was it the brother?
Yeah, no, my father, I remember distinctly when I had to choose my subjects for O-level and I had gone through the columns, as I referred to, and picked what I wanted. And my father went through them and crossed it out and said, here you can do biology, here you can do chemistry, here you can do physics. And he went through it and created something which I was quite taken aback by, but I'm not sure that we had any real discussion about it. That's the way it was.
Okay. That's the way it was. And then you went to the secondary school. Was it far away or was it around the place?
Everything was very local.
And was there again all girls?
Actually, I was referring to my secondary school, which was all girls.
All girls.
My primary school, which we called junior school in England, was mixed.
Oh, mixed. And then how was the secondary school experience?
Reasonably fun, I think. Reasonably fun. I'm not sure I was very good at that many subjects, but I was an all-rounder. I was perceived as one of the four best students in a class, in all the classes. So we were four friends. We stuck together. In my view, they were all really very smart and scientific and so on. I just happened to hang out with them. Some might call it imposter syndrome, but I think it goes a bit further than that.
So were you academically challenged at that point? I mean, do you think courses were hard or you were just not inclined as much?
I found studies reasonably hard.
Why is that?
I don't know. I don't know. I think one big thing was I didn't like reading. When I was very young, I didn't really like reading.
Really?
Yep. And I remember when I was 11, the secondary school had identified that she really needs to learn more, read more. They gave my mother a list of recommended books and I flipped almost overnight. I used to then go to the library all the time, take out books all the time. I used to read before bedtime and in the morning even. So I really enjoyed it. But I think it's very important to teach your kids to read, enjoy reading from an early age. And I do think that that actually has caused a gap in knowledge. Even if it was only the very formative years, I think that's impacted my future trajectory.
You mean not reading enough?
Yeah, not reading enough as a child.
And you think it's very important because this is for our listeners to know that why is reading so important, Aarti?
So look, I've taken an academic and a professional route. Left to my own devices, I would have taken a more liberal arts route. I loved dancing. I wanted to become a professional Indian dancer. But that was just not going to happen in my family. It was not going to happen. That would only ever remain a hobby. So I think I believe that I have the potential to become really good in the field of my choice. I was pushed into a direction which was not necessarily my choice, even though I successfully exercised many choices along the way. And having gone into that side of things, it would have been helpful had my natural inclination been a little bit more towards the intellectual. So if you know that your kids are going to go in the intellectual professional side, then support them on that side from an early age. Find ways to do it, even if they resist. Find fun ways for them to do it. And this is all very rich coming from me. I don't think I did that with my own children.
Well, but at least it's important for our listeners to know, Aarti. So
it's also, sorry to interrupt you, Sanjay, it's also thanks to conversations like this that we come to these realizations. Yeah.
Absolutely. But you made a comment. I just want to understand a little bit more. If you had a choice, you would have become a dancer, an Indian dancer. Were you doing dancing at that as you were growing up? Was that something of a passion for you?
Absolutely. I took up Bharatanatyam. I don't remember how old I was. I must have been 10, 11, 12, something like that. I did it until I was around 17, 18. And I absolutely loved it. When I was 16, I wanted to go to Kalakshetra in Chennai and pursue dancing. But I knew it wasn't an option.
Because obviously parents didn't think it was a profession or it could make, you know.
Well, Indian parents, traditional Indian trajectory.
Yeah.
I remember the longest time I almost, you know, in my mind cursed my parents. Why did you move out of India? Why did you move? I would have liked to have all of the opportunities that you had in India and you don't have them in the same way when you're overseas as you do in India. Or you have to make an extra effort when you're not in India.
Why do you say that? You think looking back, if they had stayed in India, you would have had a different career trajectory or different personal trajectory?
I think that I think it's common knowledge, but Indians who moved out of India a long time ago stick to the values that they had then and did not keep pace with the evolution of society as it happened, the modernization of society as it happened in India. They adjusted to their environment, in my case, the UK, but sticking to the very traditional values. And had we stayed in India, I just think that there would have been so many options to learn dancing, probably from even a much younger age. I don't think when I started Bharatanatyam in England, I don't think we had been looking for it. An opportunity presented itself. There was a woman who didn't live very far away, who was looking for students because she was a dancer from India. And so that's how it came into my life. Whereas had we been in India, I'm sure there's dance schools galore. And it could have been Bharatanatyam, it could have been Kathak, it could have been anything. Right. And that's one example. And the other example is later in life. I was introduced to so many Indian suitors for marriage and wasn't really very, very happy with any of them. And again, I thought, my God, if we were in India, the choice would be so much bigger. So you have to make just extra efforts when you're abroad.
Yeah. You know, that syndrome that you talked about to your parents, we call it the frozen in time syndrome. That's what most Indians who have moved out, they get frozen in time with the values, while people in India have long moved on and to be more adaptive. So you would have preferred, obviously, you would have had a lot more choices. You would have been in Southex enjoying all the great shopping and the foods in the Southex markets. But then you were here and you were dealt the hand that you were dealt and you went at it. So what happened after secondary school, Aarti?
Just to make one point clear, I mean, I'm very grateful for everything that I've had, and being in England brought opportunities which I may never have had in India, right? So I don't want it to come across the wrong way. It's just that at certain times in my life and as I was growing up, these thoughts went through my head and I really, really missed it, even though I didn't know it very well. But so you asked what happened after secondary school. I wanted to study languages in university. Parents told me that I would end up as a bilingual secretary if I did that, and I needed to do something smarter. And therefore, in England at that time, we had a book called UCCA, the UCCA book. It was like the size of a phone, and you would click through it, and it had a few hundred pages. It had literally every single course offered by every single university in the UK in it. And I stumbled across law with French, law with German, and these kind of oddities. And I thought, wow, well, I'm sure everybody speaks French. I'll do law with German law. So I applied for law with German law. My parents were very happy with that because it was law, ticking in a good old Indian box. So I went off to King's College London and studied law with German law, which was a very important part of my life.
So there was no strategy or any kind of planning. You just picked that because, as you said, that was in the book. And, you know, Indian parents, we call it two-profession syndrome, or maybe three with law, doctor, engineer, or lawyer. And so you made them happy. And this was a little further away from home, Aarti?
This was in London proper. So I did live away from home for the whole 4 years, just coming on the vacations.
You were out for the first time. You were coming out from an all-girls school. How was that whole experience when you started law with German, so to speak?
It was the tough thing for me was the intellectual side of it. I mean, the social side, I never had a problem. I found it very easy to make friends. I was quite lively and witty, so not a problem there. But the intellectual side was a real challenge. King's College London is very prestigious for law. It's a hard school to get into. I think I got in more on charm than anything else. And also because my German was very good. But law requires a lot of independent thinking and it requires a lot of reading. Two things which the reading was, I mean, it's not fiction, so it's not like you're going to have fun reading it. It's, you know, heavy cases, lots of judges' opinions that you have to plow through. A lot of reading in a short time, a lot of pressure, very hard to keep up with that. And then the whole independent thinking. When you're raised by strict Indian parents, you're not necessarily encouraged to develop those capabilities, critical thinking. You don't question, you accept, you respect. You don't question so much, you go with the flow. And I don't like strive. So I go with the flow quite often, or perhaps often to my detriment. And so independent thinking really challenged me, as did the reading side of it. And it knocked my confidence for six. It was really bad. So my first and second year, I mean, I got through. I didn't do particularly well, but I got through. And it was only in my third year, which was a year abroad. So we did a diploma in German civil law, which I spent in South Germany. It's only there where, because I was in Germany, I was using the language that I was the best at. I fully integrated with German friends. I didn't really hang out with the other exchange students at all. And when I came back from that year, my confidence was sky high. And therefore, my final year in university was excellent. And I did really well. But it was a question of confidence. It was a question of really believing in my ability to do it. And I wasn't scared anymore. And that's simply because I had spent 1 year where I could play my strengths, and that had reassured me and given me inner strength to do better on the intellectual side.
Yeah, a lot to unpack there. Just to go back for a minute, where did you pick up such fluent German? I mean, you speak five languages, Aarti. Where did you pick up German? I presume parents were not speaking it at home.
No. So in the school that I was in, when we started secondary school at age 11, French was compulsory from the get-go. And in the second year, German and Latin were compulsory, each for 6 months. And in the third year, we had to elect either German or Latin, and I chose German. So I was learning it from age 12, basically. And did it all the way to A level, and then continued it in university, spent a year in Germany, and then I later went to live and work in Germany.
So coming back to Lodz College, the first 2 years you said were very, very hard intellectually, because did you at any point think of quitting, or why did I pick this profession or getting into German law? Were there any thoughts of that?
I was miserable. I was miserable because I wasn't doing well. I mean, I was passing and getting through, but at the end of the day, I still don't consider myself an intellectual of any kind. I know how to ask the right questions and I know how to join dots, but I'm not a particularly well-read, you know, scientific, mathematical mind or anything like that. And so all of that caused me to struggle a lot. I didn't think of quitting because, well, you don't quit when you're Indian, do you? You don't quit. So that quitting was not even an option. You just had to get through it the best you could.
How did you get through it? This is for our listeners when they face tough times, because that must have been really hard. And by the way, you're the first guest on our show, and we've had many who said, I'm not intellectually inclined. I don't read a whole range of stuff. And that takes a lot of confidence and being in touch with yourself. But anyways, so as you said, Indians, quitting is not an option. But when you're going through those tough times, for our listeners who obviously all of us go through that, how did you get through some of those tough times in the first 2 years?
I think the answer to that question is, in the words of my father, muddle through. When marriage was tough, he used to say muddle through, just muddle through. And when I reflect, I mean, that's how we get through anything, right? It's the steadfastness and just carry on. You will learn along the way. You will grow through along the way. And probably nothing is easy. The grass is always greener. There's always something easier. But, you know, whatever, unless you feel that you're really being forced into something which is absolutely not for you, then stand up for yourself and quit and take, don't quit, but define a different trajectory and find a way to go from one to the other. But otherwise, just stick with it, muddle through, and take what it gives you. Nothing is easy. So don't assume that by quitting it would get easier, or by choosing something else it would be easier. I don't believe that.
When you say muddle through for our audience, you mean just work it through and just go along?
Stick at it and do the best you can. Stick at it, do the best you can. I mean, I started meditation much later, many years later. I wish I had had it when I was younger, because that has given me a grounding and a perception or a perspective, which is so much bigger, which probably also comes with age and maturity. But many people do start meditation, or they have tools be it sport, be it gym, be it some other hobby. But I think self-realization is very important. Introspection is very important. Quiet time and being with yourself and being honest with yourself is very important. And so you just go through it day by day.
Again, you said some very important points for our listeners. Introspection, quiet time, whether it's meditation, sports, etc. Because as I said, you have said some very, very important things about yourself in terms of recognizing it. At what point did you kind of recognize your strengths and weaknesses? Just like you talked about that maybe I'm not, and I hope I'm saying it right, I'm not an intellectual. And that's a big statement to say for someone in your position. Did it take you a long time to figure it out, or have you had that realization for a long time?
I knew that for a long time. I've always wondered how I wound up in the situations and positions that I wound up in.
How?
It's a reality. I tell you one thing, Sanjay. It's a lot easier to just be yourself and to be honest with yourself than it is to pretend that you're something that you're not. That takes a lot of energy and ultimately just will wind up defining you as something superficial or not really, not of any depth. So I'm not interested in that. I will own what I am fully.
How did you end up in all these important positions? What are the lessons to be learned from there?
Yeah. I mean, you asked me, how did I find out what I was good at and so on? And I remember realizing along this journey that probably the hardest thing to do in life is to find out what you are meant to do. What is it your kismet to be doing? That is one of the hardest things. I mean, some people just have it defined for themselves from a very early age. Maybe somebody is outstandingly good at art, or a math prodigy, or really into computer science or whatever. Some people have it easy in that sense. I didn't, because I felt I was pulling, my being was pulling in one way, my family was pulling in another. And so there was a lot of finding what is right for me in those conditioned circumstances. And it's when I enjoyed working in Germany. I worked for Daimler-Benz Aerospace, which is today part of the Airbus group. But it was when I was able to, as soon as you're able to work where you know consciously that you can apply your strengths and where you see yourself applying your strengths, that's when you're on the right path. That is when you're on the right path. Because when you're doing what you're good at, you will get better at it and you will start adding to it. Because of growth, because of exposure to the people around you, the work you have to do, you know, what you're called upon to do, that will give you additional skills and add to whatever the core point is that you brought yourself to the table. Yeah. So I remember I was reasonably good and quite strategic when I worked in Daimler-Benz Aerospace in Munich. But it's only when I went to Brussels and I became Secretary General of, at that time, the European Satellite Operators Association, ISOA, which is today just ISOA, the Global Satellite Operators Association. So I think I was around 30 or 30 plus before I realized that I'm now doing what I'm meant to do. Because I was doing advocacy. I was good at organizing. So even though I hadn't enjoyed my degree, I hadn't enjoyed studying law, I wasn't interested in law. Okay, fine. I'd successfully qualified as a solicitor in the UK. But what I had taken away from it was a certain methodical approach to thinking, a structured approach, and a certain organizational skills that I had honed in that time. And those I took away with me. And so as Secretary General of an association, I was using my organizational and management skills. I was using my language skills because I was in a multicultural, multi-company environment with people from different places. And I was using my public speaking skills, which when you're good at languages, you enjoy speaking. You enjoy communicating and engaging. So you enjoy that interaction with others, which means that you will have certain nascent strengths, which you may not know exist, but which will be drawn out of you if you're put in the right environment. And so that happened for me. And I remember becoming Secretary General, doing the public speaking, and getting a lot of praise and confidence growing because you're doing what you're good at and you're being recognized for it, and therefore you get better at it. The funny thing is, when I joined the UN, I mean, fast forwarding here, now we're in a quasi-ambassadorial type role. And now I really realize that this is what I was meant to do. I don't know if that makes sense, because obviously you're living in the present at any given moment. But for example, when I was representing satellite operators and the satellite communications sector, often when we would produce brochures on the role of satellites for the Sustainable Development Goals or to bridge the digital divide or whatever, I would draft things and my members would say to me, you haven't mentioned satellite once. And I would say, you don't need to. You need to speak in their language, but it's still good for us as a sector. But what I was doing was I was approaching it from a high-level ambassadorial approach rather than an industry-centric approach. And that wasn't always appreciated. But that's precisely what I'm called upon to do now. You know? So, yeah, that all sounds rather complex. I hope some of it made sense.
No, it all made sense. A lot to unpack. So this is again, very important for our listeners. You had a light bulb moment, so to speak, or whatever you want to call it, a little bit of flickering when you went to Germany for Airbus, and then a little bit more brighter when you joined the association and the bulb completely went off at UN. Were you ever in a job, because this is again for our listeners that I want to come to, where the bulb was completely dark and you said, hey, what the hell am I doing? Because you said a very, very important point that you need to find where your strengths are and how you can engage. Now, you know, there are people who go through their whole life not knowing that, and that's a shame because everybody has something that is unique and something that they can contribute. And so how do they find that is what you are kind of defining. And if they're not in that situation, what should they do? Were you ever in a situation where the light bulb, or was it all a progression of the things that you were good at?
No. When I qualified as a solicitor, I had to do a training contract for 2 years. I enjoyed a training contract for a solicitor in the UK is 4 seats, so 6 months in 4 different departments. And I hated half of it. The part I hated was the heavy reading stuff, contracts, licenses, this kind of thing. What I really enjoyed was the litigation, which was going to court, representing, but also reflecting on very interesting strategic questions. I love getting my head around complex problems and the process that reveals itself to you slowly, but often very slowly, but surely over time. But generally during those 2 years, I was leaving the office at 5:30, while everybody else was staying there until 6, 7, 8 at night, because that's what the job demanded. But I really didn't enjoy it. I remember I used to avoid the lifts. I would run down the fire escape in the hope that no partner from the law firm would see me. And invariably, I would bump into one. Good night, and it's 5 p.m. Uh-huh. So I guess you could say that's when the light was not very bright at all. I didn't enjoy it. And accordingly, at the end of those 2 years, so in the UK, I don't know if it's changed now, but you secure yourself a training contract, which is a fixed 2-year contract, and you hope that at the end of it, they offer you a permanent post. And I was the only one out of six trainees that year who was not offered a permanent contract. But for me, it was fine. I had applied for an MBA anyway, so I was a little taken aback, obviously. It's never nice to hear rejection, but I forced myself to be upbeat and I told them the truth. And I said, that's fine. I've applied for an MBA anyway. And they were like, what? You've applied for an MBA? And then there was a French lawyer in that firm. That firm had 80% German-speaking clients. So I'd stayed with, you know, my calling, which was the linguistic side. But there was one French lawyer there, and I had applied to a so-called Grande École. It's one of the French equivalent of an Ivy League school in France. And I'd been offered a place. And when the French lawyer found out, he shared that with other partners. And all of a sudden, they wanted me to stay, and they offered me a permanent position. But I had already made up my mind that this wasn't for me and I needed to move on. So,
wow. So if some of our listeners are in a position where the light bulb is very dark, you recommend that they should move on, make some changes?
I almost feel like what I did was reckless. And it just happened to be lucky because they weren't offering me a position anyway. So good job that I had another plan. But I have forever struggled between this pull between the head, like family, and the head, what is sensible approach, and the heart and the instinct. I've always struggled with that. That's really tough. That's really tough. Lucky for those of them and those people who know what they're going to do when they're so lucky. But others, many, many people find themselves in this situation, I believe. And that's really hard to figure out. Would I advise leaving? I would advise don't stay in something that you're miserable, because it will destroy you and it will crush whatever you do have to offer. What I have learned is that, you know, even through doing interviews like this, I mean, you came to me and you said there's so much that can help inspire others and help others. And I was invited to do an interview, probably the first one ever, about women in tech. It was organized by the ITU and the UN 3 years ago or so. And I felt very uncomfortable speaking about myself because it feels like you want to talk about yourself and it's very narcissistic. But the feedback that I got two messages, one from a girl in Pakistan, another one from a girl in India, who said that I had helped them. I had given them courage. I was blown away. You never think that telling your own story is going to help anybody else, right? And so now I don't shy away from it because I realize that from the simplest thing, which is not intellectual at all, it's just speaking about your own journey, which is not a skill. Every single person has a journey, right? And to the extent they're able to articulate it, they can probably help someone. So whether you are the most intellectual or somebody who has soft skills, but is very strong in their soft skills, which in the traditional Indian sense of the world may not be intellectual. I think that everybody has something to offer. And if you find yourself in a place which is dark, you have to find a way to go to introspect. You have to find a way that you can go within yourself, look within, and take time for yourself that you can be guided by your inner master. And as soon as you start taking time for that, things will start falling into place. That happened for me. The moment I started meditation, within 1 week, things started changing for me. And it wasn't that things started changing in the world. It's that you start changing. You've become more accepting of yourself as you are. You realize that you don't have to. In my case, I realized that I was in a constant fight with wanting to change things. But in fact, the change that needed to happen was within me. You have to be happy with yourself and where you are. And if you can do that, your inner light will start shining bright. And that itself will create possibilities for you.
So your inner light will start shining bright and will start creating possibilities. That's a very, very important thing. And that came through you through meditation. It can come through many other means too, as long as you start introspecting, right? Aarti, along this journey, have there been any mentors who have been there for you, who guided you in this journey? Or has it just been self-reflection, along the way?
You know, even when I moved around the world, and a lot of this is about being alone, right? You are forced into introspection when you are out of your comfort zone, when you're alone, when you're lost, when you're in that dark place. And I moved to Paris. I moved to New York. I moved to Munich. I moved to Brussels. And on each occasion, I was on my own. And that's not, even if you speak languages, which helps, that's not easy, but I feel like I was sent a mother figure in each circumstance. It was an aunt of mine in Paris. It was a lady who believed that she had been my mother in a previous life in Munich. It was somebody else in New York. I mean, wherever I've been, there's been somebody who has been an older, wiser person who I've always been able to spend time with and reflect on, which helps in the personal development, because you're not just hanging out with people your age and playing or doing, or you're occupying yourself with activity, which is distraction essentially, but you're putting yourself with people who can raise you up in some shape or form, be it by virtue of their experience, their age, their perspectives, their wisdom, their maturity, or their position. So I wouldn't zoom in on individual people per se, but I think I've always benefited from having people around me that I have, who have given me access to them in a way that I could benefit from it.
Well, that's good to know. Aarti, you talked a lot about meditation. Do you think your definition of success has changed over a period of time? I mean, when you were probably coming out of law school, there was probably a definition. Right now, has that changed over a period of time? How you define success for yourself?
Yes, I wanted to earn a lot of money. And I don't know if that's something to do with the definition of success, but I mean, intellectually, even though I don't define myself as a traditional intellectual, intellectually, for me, success was finding what I was meant to do. That was always, you know, where I would find happiness. And I knew that's finding what I was meant to do. So that was my own personal definition of success. However, it's also driven by recognition, ambition, and the desire to earn more money. And I've been challenged with that as I came to the UN, because I come from industry and I earned well. And you come to the UN and you actually earn less than you did in industry, despite being in a senior position. And that's quite a shock, because you think, wow, I'm becoming the director of space for the United Nations. That's got to be, you know, the pinnacle of it all. And of course it is. But then to realize that materially, it's not what you expected, was quite a shock to the system. And it made me wonder, wow, the sacrifice I'm having to make now. I mean, in my previous job, I already worked 12, 14, 15 hours a day regularly, and my family suffered from it. But the sacrifice that I've had to make for this job, and then for lower material reward, makes you really question, what have I done? What have I done? But that's when you come back to the calling and you realize, yeah, but you have an opportunity to influence, change, and help and drive progress on so many different levels by virtue of your position. So it's made me embrace this success and, out of necessity, obviously give less importance to the material side. I don't know if that answers that question.
Yeah,
but
you did. It has changed in terms of obviously less material and more impact.
Yeah.
That's what you're focused on. Aarti, you had a very eventful life journey. If you were to pick a few inflection points, I have my view, but I want to hear from you. Which are the two or three key inflection points that kind of the trajectory of your life change dramatically, if you were to pick? Because again, it's all for our listeners to know. And sometimes it's hard to go back and talk about that.
So the inflection points for me, one, deciding to apply for an MBA and going for that and making a complete change, which meant going abroad, going for a different subject of which I had no experience and knowledge. That was a massive inflection point. The MBA was the hardest year of my life. It was truly the hardest year of my life. But had I not done that, I would not be where I am today. And so obviously everything is easier in retrospect. You look back and you think, wow, that was really important. And I wasn't encouraged to go for the MBA. So the MBA school itself, even though they were offering me a position, offering me a spot, they actually called me and said, we advise you to think very carefully before accepting this offer. You only have 2 years of work experience. Most people who do an MBA have a lot more. we fear that you're going to be one of those who's waiting the longest to find a permanent position afterwards. And so that, I mean, that's, you know, puts the fear of God in you, that you're about to take this enormous leap. And they've told you that they don't think that you will necessarily succeed or it won't be easy for you. It wasn't easy by any means, but I was the first person in my MBA to get a job, and I got it within 1.5 months of starting the MBA. So voila. So there you are. Things have a way of working out. Is it luck? I don't know. I think being sincere to yourself and being honest with yourself and with others has a lot to do with it in terms of, you know, do good and good will come back to you in that sense of it. The next inflection point was the decision to leave Munich. I was very, very, very happy in Munich. In Munich, I got my culture back. I started Kapuk in Munich. When I went to university, I stopped Indian dancing because I was moving out of home. I didn't do that anymore. Gone off to university, gone off to do an MBA. Thought it was all behind me, was back in Germany for work. Didn't think I would go back to Germany after studying there for a year. Went there, started learning Kathak from a German woman, which eventually led me to be affiliated with Kadam, the dance school in Ahmedabad, because she was a student of Kadam. And I started playing Tanpura, instructed by a German sitar player. And we performed concerts regularly in Munich. I had my name on posters playing Tanpura. I don't have one. He would have to teach me again if I was to go back. But culturally, my life was so rich. I was in an environment where I could use my language skills on a daily basis. I was in an environment where it wasn't a city, like a London city rat race, where people look at what time do you come, what time do you leave, very gray, very compartmentalized approach to work. In Germany, in Munich, you know, we work and we could see the mountains in the background. They worked hard and they played hard. My balanced lifestyle was absolutely tremendous. I was so happy in Munich, but I always wanted to get married and have a family. And I realized that I was never going to. I had an international persona. And when I worked for Daimler-Benz Aerospace, it was not an integrated European company at the time. It was a German engineering company. And I was working with Germans, which is fine. I love working with Germans. I still enjoy that. But I never met anybody whose background could marry with mine. And I needed to do something. And I was invited by that German company to, would I be interested in a job in Brussels? And I knew that Brussels was the European Commission. It was more international. It was less provincial than Munich. And so purely for the reason of knowing that I needed to go to the next step in my life, I said yes to that and left a very, very happy environment where I could do everything that I wanted to do. I had a great balance, Indian, German, whatever. And I was plunged into misery in Brussels, plunged into misery. Didn't know the first thing about lobbying, advocacy, was the first time I felt being a young girl. I was 30, I was a woman, but I felt like a young girl in a very man's world. And I was the German representative in a European joint venture. And because myself and the British representative, we were 50% of that joint venture, the French and the Italians didn't like us. And when it came to me, the French and the Italian representative tried to really attack me at a very personal level so that I would not perform at a professional level. And they were very successful with that for the first few years. And then after a while, it takes time to grow into a position, like it's taking me time to grow into the position I'm in now. Equally, when I moved to Brussels, I had to grow into that. I had to find my bearings and, you know, get my footing before I could start to deliver any kind of value. So that was a major inflection point. And meditation was the other one. I remember this was in February 2000, almost exactly 24 years ago. I picked up a friend of mine, taking her to an Indian friend's dinner. We were going for a music party, traditional Indian music party. There was an Afghani who spoke Punjabi who would sing ghazals. He had been taught by Ghulam Ali. There was a Sikh friend who was amateur sitar player. There was a tabla player. I sang a little. So we were a small group and they hosted music parties. We did this regularly. It was all part of my rich cultural life in Munich. And when Fatima, my friend, when I picked her up, she got in the car, she said, "Oh, how are you?" And I said, "Oh, I'm totally depressed," for whatever reason at the time. And she said, "Have you considered meditation?" And I had this notion of somebody who's going to sit there, you know, cross-legged, chanting Om for hours. And I was like, I don't have the discipline to do that. I was like, no, that's not for me. Never going to do that. And I started the next morning. She worked on me that evening and I started the next morning. And it got to the point where, despite loving my job, I used to rush home when the day was over. I could not wait to get home to sit down and meditate because it was doing me so much good. It was resourcing me in a way that nothing had. And it was taking the anger and the frustration out of me, which I think had been pent up through this whole journey, really, of being conditioned, being put in different circumstances, trying. I mean, I kept jumping from one thing to another, not knowing what was the right thing to do, simply because you're looking for the right thing for you and you won't rest. You don't have peace of mind. You don't have inner peace until you find it. But when I started meditating, I started finding it. It was the week after starting meditation that the offer for Brussels came. My second day in Brussels, I met my husband, who is today my husband. You know, the job started falling into place slowly but surely. The offer to become Secretary General of the Association happened. One thing led to the other. Everything started falling into place. And it's because of the inner change that comes when you take time to introspect and meditate. Heartfulness. Sahaj Marg.
Yeah. Well, those are three amazing inflection points. And thanks so much for sharing with us. Aarti, towards the end, we basically do some lightning round of questions. We ask the same things to all our guests. What is your definition of Indianness? You kind of have defined it in so many ways, but your definition, everybody has their own.
Gosh, I wish I'd had the questions in advance. I have been hurt a couple of times in my life, and these two occasions have marked me, even if the second time, which was very recently, it has affected me a little less. Being an Indian who's been raised abroad, I'm not considered by Indian Indians as a real Indian. And I struggle with that. I find that hurtful because you do realize that you're different by reason of your upbringing, your cultural heritage or whatever. And I've always been different, whether I was in the UK, whether I was in France, in New York, Germany, or here. And what makes you different is your culture. So the Indianness comes from culture. I find that one is being an Indian, you're so fortunate to come from this rich culture of spirituality where yoga or meditation, which is Raja Yoga, the highest form of yoga, is part of our heritage and it's part of us. And we have good fortune to have such easy access to it if we want. So for me, that's a definition of Indianness.
Great answer. Culture. Aarti, one person who's been the most influential person in your journey, just one. There are many you've talked about, but just if you were to say, talk about one person.
If I could turn my mother and my father into one, it would be that one. I would probably go with my mother. Always been behind me, even when I arguably failed, has still picked me up. And even when people wondered, why is she doing an MBA when it's never good when you're too educated and you're Indian. But she, for her, well, it was education, therefore she could justify it. Even when I announced that I was going to marry a non-Indian, she carried around his CV, which showed Harvard and MIT and these things and European Commission. You know, she found the boxes that needed ticking on the Indian side and championed it. And the resilience that I've seen in her. Ambition, drive, dominance, resilience. Some of those can be negative, but if you can channel them and use the spiritual side of your existence to soften the rough edges of those qualities, I think that's probably been the most influential part for me.
She sounds amazing. If, you know, Nike has a tagline that says, just do it. What would be Aarti's tagline?
Aarti's tagline. Be yourself.
That's a good one. And that's what you've been, incredibly.
Be true to yourself.
Yeah. Finally, Aarti, where do you still have so much more to do. Where do you see this journey going from here?
I still live in the belief that things are, well, in the mistaken belief for sure, that things just unfold around me and don't have actually anything to do with me, and that they just happen. I don't know if I should say happen to me, but they just happen. And then I find myself in that environment and I start unfolding or growing. Where do I see it going? So I don't have a plan. I don't know what will come next. I deeply miss my family. I'm in Vienna while my husband is still in Brussels. My youngest child is still at home. I had to give away my dog. I mean, the sacrifice is enormous. I just hope that I start seeing that I'm able to make a difference so that the sacrifice feels a little less. And if I'm able to make a difference, then I hope that I can make a big contribution to whatever it is that I can contribute to. I mean, I'm doing this because I think it's an opportunity to drive positive change. And that's what I would like to have as a legacy, wherever the journey takes me.
That's fantastic. And I have a feeling it's going to take you in some amazing places, whether it's space or somewhere else, who knows. But Aarti, thank you so much. This has been one of the most honest and candid interviews that I've had the pleasure of hosting, and I'm sure our guests and listeners are really, really going to enjoy it. So thanks for being with us, but thanks for being so honest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Indianist podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future inspirational stories.